From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on Lake Effect, as cyber attacks increase, the need for cybersecurity professionals to combat them is outpacing the supply.
Then a new report from the Nature Conservancy shows how nature itself can help us combat greenhouse gases.
Natural climate solutions can help fight climate change with a potential benefit that's equivalent to one-fifth of our nation's current net emissions. And that's the same as if every car and truck in the country stopped polluting the climate.
Why the February issue of Milwaukee Magazine is completely dedicated to the city's art scene.
Milwaukee, in a lot of ways, is a great art city, a great performing art city, a great fine art city. So we want to just sort of dig into that idea and look into why it punches above its weight and how long it's been doing that.
And we'll have a preview of the 6th annual Latino Arts Guitar Festival taking place this Saturday.
Lake Effect is next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Earlier this week, a report on NPR said that cyber attacks originating in China are continuing to increase, even as the number of indictments and charges against hackers has increased as well. The proliferation of online transactions and the so-called Internet of Things, devices that allow us to connect remotely, has raised the risk of hacking across a wide spectrum of our lives.
But while indictments and arrests are happening, the problem is outpacing the efforts of people who do cybersecurity work, in part because there aren't enough of them. Jen Rathburn is a partner with the law firm of Foley & Lardner, specializing in data protection and security. Tina Chang is the CEO of the Wisconsin-based SysLogic, which works in the cybersecurity field. They told Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why the need for cybersecurity professionals has outpaced the supply.
They predict by 2021 there'll be 3.5 million unfilled jobs in cybersecurity. And I think really that comes from the fact that cyber attacks are increasing. You know, the cost of cyber attacks are now over $1.1 million on average. That's new stats coming out in January. On average, it takes 201 days to even find a cyber attacker. You know, information systems are getting more complex. We're introducing, you know, the Internet of Things and IoT. Every company wants to be a data company. And so for all of those reasons, you know, it's just becoming a lot more sophisticated systems to protect, and the attackers are becoming more sophisticated. And the funds, unfortunately, to fund cybersecurity within companies is still on the lower side.
This is the idea that, that companies are adopting all sorts of IoT solutions to their products, but the kinds of attacks they might experience, they're not necessarily predicting. And so suddenly they find themselves realizing that they don't have the kind of security that they need.
Yes, oftentimes there's new viruses, there's zero-day events. There's lots of sophisticated attackers from, you know, other governments, APT attacks, which we talk about. So attacks are just have been on the rise in the past couple of years. And so there's more need for cybersecurity professionals, not just from a technical perspective, but also from a legal and compliance perspective, because many different frameworks are now being passed through onto companies. For example, if you're a government contractor for Department of Defense, you have to comply with certain frameworks. If you're in the healthcare industry, if you are in the financial industry, many people have heard about GDPR, which is a European law that came into effect last May. California is implementing a new law to be effective. So there's just an uptick not only in attacks, but also legal and compliance requirements.
Tina Chang, where does your company find itself in this equation?
So we are a 23-year-old information services firm, and I'll tell you, while cybersecurity has existed for a long time, we've seen an incredible uptick over the last 6 years. And going back to what Jen had talked about regarding Internet of Things, I think part of the momentum is really because organizations are looking more and more not only to connect within their organizations, but connect outside of their organizations. And anytime you are reaching outside of your organization and connecting in ways that you haven't before, you are opening up walls that you have been traditionally used to protecting. So we've come into play really helping organizations not only innovate around Internet of Things, but then understanding, and more importantly, how they protect as they're connecting with their customers or their supply chain even more.
Have you experienced this this shortage, if you will?
Definitely. Absolutely. We've had open positions for the last 3 years that go unfilled, and we are no different than many organizations, both public and private. So as Jen had mentioned, we are going to have over 3 million unfilled positions worldwide. And this really puts a challenge not only on education and academia to groom, but also on the private sector to upskill and train, because you can hire every single person that's going to be coming out of a program in the near term, and you still won't fill the labor shortage.
So within the general field, give us a sense for, you know, what are the kinds of positions that are out there when we're talking about cybersecurity professionals? What are we talking about?
Sure. So I think most people tend to think about them as the technical, really behind the computer types. And it's not just that. Jen had mentioned that cybersecurity really stretches across a vast array of skill sets, from governance and compliance that really get into the legal and insurance worlds, all the way down to operations and technical. We tend to focus on the technical side at SysLogic, which then opens up dozens and dozens of different types of security jobs and skill sets that are required, everything from perimeter and network security, now all the way through application and data security, with the notion that we were used to just protecting our walls, making sure somebody didn't get into our house. Now we have to assume that they're going to get into the house, and then we have to understand how to protect what's in it, the applications, the data, or the content that's really valuable.
And, you know, it's not just technical. What I have seen, which is very interesting, what Tina brought up, is that we do assume now that you are not going to prevent a cyber attack. It's really to prepare for a cyber attack. So a few years ago, I mean, really the theme has switched from, you know, having IT just handle cybersecurity. It's really a risk management issue. It's a strategy issue. I mean, the number one thing you can do is develop an incident response team and a plan to respond to a cyber attack. And who's the best at that? Individuals that are thinking strategy. So really, it's moving, preventing cyber attacks and, you know, preparing for them up to the C-suite. So it's risk managers, it's legal, it's compliance. A lot of chief information security officers, CISOs as we call them, a lot of those individuals are actually now becoming lawyers or compliance officials. And instead of reporting directly up to the CIO, they're having either cross reports or direct reports up to legal and compliance because, you know, a lot of times in companies, people just want to roll out the new laptop. They want the new piece of technology. But the chief information security officer really is responsible for looking at privacy by design, security by design. If we implement this new piece of technology, are we bringing too much security risk in? So it's really, it's like thinking outside the box of lots of different individuals that could fill these roles.
You're absolutely right, Jen. And to your point, it is stretching technology people to have to be strategists, to not just do, but to think.
Well,
and that's a new realm.
And that must mean also that if we're talking about taking people who aren't traditionally technology people and moving them into the technology field.
You betcha. I liken this to the very early days when websites started to emerge. Everybody thought it was a technical person that was there to create a website. And what we quickly recognize is that this was one of those areas that stretched across an enterprise, from strategy to marketing to communication to the business units, and cyber is no different. And so what we're seeing, or at least what I'm seeing, is the best types of cyber professionals tend to be very collaborative. They are committed to being intellectually curious and curious about what's happening and how others think, so that they could understand and predict what doesn't even exist today. And I think when you end up pairing collaboration with curiosity and then a very, very deep commitment to research, it makes you one that's constantly looking for that next thing. And that's what cyber is really about, because it's constantly changing. The viruses are constantly changing.
And also communication. I mean, as we all know, a lot of individuals in the technical field are linear thinkers, and sometimes they get really deep into the technical speak. I find that a lot of really successful cybersecurity professionals are able to take that, you know, deep technical knowledge and be able to communicate risk in particular to the board. Because the board, it's very difficult. Many board members have no technical background. And so being a very good communicator as well is very helpful.
Well, and so what's the kind of work that the business community can be doing with academia so that the people who are coming out of school in a variety of fields find themselves, you know, either funneled or considering this profession?
So I think the private sector in working with academia, it really starts with a partnership of how do we bring people from the private sector that can even help teach the curriculum to the academic centers, because right now it's not like you have a plethora of trained professors in cybersecurity. So you've got to activate that from the private sector, bring them into the university or even high school levels to start planting seeds of how to think about cyber. The other thing that we've seen a couple of the local institutions here do really well is they're reaching out to private sectors saying, what does that curriculum even look like, right? So if you're actually doing this work on the ground, how do you help us make this not only practical, but thoughtful in the way that we're designing people on how to think for the future? And private sector is going to help academia get there. Academia will not get there on their own.
And, you know, we just hosted a few weeks ago with the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance. We did a workforce development session, and the assistant dean from UWM came and spoke. And it's really trying to also get students interested in this area. You know, I think a lot of students think it's very technical, and maybe, you know, some of them think it's not as exciting as as we do. But really, I mean, cybersecurity professionals, and I mean this truly, are the superheroes. I mean, what is happening is, in particular in the Midwest, you know, we're getting hit by these very sophisticated attackers. I mean, they really are our frontline defense to defend our companies, to protect our IP, to protect consumer information. And the more information that leaves our doors, it really affects the U.S.'s competitive advantage. And so they really are pseudo-military. They are our first line of defense. I mean, the government is not able to put, you know, individuals into all of our companies, and nobody's breaking in anymore on foot. They're not going to come in and steal something. They're going to steal it through, you know, a cyber, you know, connection, you know, through networks, et cetera. And so it's a really exciting job. And I want Tina to talk about it, but Tina has a really good idea about how to get more individuals interested in this.
Do we need to get them uniforms, badges, capes?
Hey, listen, capes. You know, I definitely, you joke, but I definitely think that cyber needs a rebrand. So to Jen's point, these are really heroes. And the trouble with cyber attacks is typically nobody wants to talk about them. So it's almost the more quiet it is, the better life is. But the people doing the work behind the scenes are truly doing work that can cause companies and organizations millions of dollars if not done right. So
how much are you looking for realized talent versus recognizing potential in this field?
We are definitely looking for potential in this field. If we just left our recruiting team to look for realized talent, they'll be looking forever. Not only because there are absolutely more jobs than there are people, but the competition for those people is fierce. And so recommendation number one to companies is please show a little love to your cyber people, because I guarantee you everybody is calling on them right now to try and recruit them away from you. That being said, you really have to identify talent and interest internal to your organization, whether they have competency or not, and train them, because this is a field that everybody's learning. Everybody's learning at the same time. So it leads itself to a vast opportunity for us to look at alternative worker channels and people that are underemployed and or want career shifts, and really groom them into a field that, again, is new to everybody.
Oh, I was just going to ask how you recognize potential.
Well, I think you recognize potential is what Tina said before, is somebody that's really interested in the space and is a good communicator and may have non-traditional skills that are, you know, auditing skills. A lot of the cybersecurity frameworks, you know, are based on auditing, come from a compliance environment, not just technical. But in the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance meeting, you know, we had a large group of people that was actually co-hosted by InfraGuard, which is a public-private partnership with the FBI. But I will tell you that, you know, a lot of the individuals in the audience said, I won't move for more money, but I really want training. I mean, they really want training because, again, they are a first line of defense. You know, they feel cybersecurity individuals, in the event a company experiences an incident, which almost all do, they feel very guilty and they're just wanting to suck in training. So I would say to any company to keep your individuals happy, which, by the way, they get about 50 emails a week for new jobs, just so everybody knows, is to really invest in that training because that is what I would say from the audience last week is the number one thing they're looking for.
Definitely. And as a firm, I will mention that training is huge. And the number one area that I don't think corporations and organizations do well is to provide that training budget. Everybody wants training, of course, but cybersecurity is one of those fields that you absolutely must have it. Or watch out, the investment that you're making in your people will lag very quickly because they're not keeping up with the pace of the change. That being said, I think locally here, we need more. We need more of our academic partners to step up with programs. They are starting to emerge, so that is great to see. We're seeing some momentum. I think we could fuel that momentum with some investments from the private sector. But also, Syslogic recognizes that there isn't a lot of local training. And so we're coming out with one of the only locally provided training programs on cybersecurity next month.
Jen Rathburn is a partner with the law firm of Foley and Lardner, specializing in data protection and security. Tina Chang is the CEO of Wisconsin-based Syslogic, which works in the cybersecurity field. They spoke with Mitch Teich.
We will take a quick break now and then learn how nature itself can help us combat greenhouse gases. Lake Effect continues with that conversation in a moment on WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Nature Conservancy, a conservation group with programs spanning the globe, hopes that a report it compiled will help build the case for natural climate solutions throughout the United States. The study is titled Natural Climate Solutions for the United States, and it shows how forests, wetlands, and agricultural lands can significantly drive down greenhouse gas pollution.
Lake Effect Susan Bent spoke with the study's lead author, Jill Fargioni, the science director of the Nature Conservancy's North America region. Fargioni says the natural idea sprouted at a meeting a few years back.
We looked at natural climate solutions, which are the protection, restoration, and improved management of natural and working lands. And that includes forests, grasslands, wetlands, and agricultural lands. And what we found was that natural climate solutions can help fight climate change with a potential benefit. It's equivalent to one-fifth of our nation's current net emissions. And that's the same as if every car and truck in the country stopped polluting the climate. So there's much bigger potential than most people realize.
Where did you draw this data from? How did you crunch it?
We looked at 21 different approaches for natural climate solutions. And so each of those was its own analysis. So we looked at, for example, the literature on how much carbon could be stored in the soils if our croplands used cover crops. We looked at how many places in the country used to have forests and don't currently and are not a road or a city and could potentially have more trees and be reforested. We looked at how much more efficiently we could use fertilizer on our cropland, and we looked at how many more street trees we could fit in our cities. And we looked at 17 other different pathways.
It's encouraging news. It also points to the fact that we, you know, globally we're losing forests. So how do you use this information to turn that trend around?
Yeah, so globally, most people realize that we're losing a lot of tropical forests, and that's a big problem for climate. And I think one of the things that our study showed was that we can make a difference even in the United States, and we are losing just under 1 million acres of forest a year, and we're losing over 1 million acre of grassland, and protecting those places by having smarter growth and funding our conservation programs so we keep marginal cropland out of production, then those are places that we can also contribute to stopping the release of climate pollution.
When you're looking at different habitats and landscapes, you would look at those elements. I mean, what is agriculturally cultivated, what is currently grassland or could be grassland, and what might be best suited for forest, looking at that palette?
That's a good question. So, you know, we looked at each different approach of those 21 different natural climate solutions, and we looked at how it could be implemented. And I think there's different things that would drive each of them. So, for example, when it comes to urban reforestation, people don't plant trees in cities because they store more carbon, even though they do. They plant trees because it's nice to live around trees. So all of these different natural climate solutions have co-benefits in addition to storing carbon. And often those will be the reason that we choose to invest in nature. So we'll invest in protecting habitats along our coast because they help reduce storm damage and coastal flooding. We'll invest in improved forest management in places that we want to reduce the risk of severe wildfires. And we'll help protect forests that provide wildlife habitat and clean water. So there's lots of different reasons that people might choose to invest more in nature.
Earlier, you mentioned looking at more efficient uses of fertilizer. Can you talk a bit more about that? Because that would be a key element of, you know, areas where agriculture is core to a region's economy.
One of the great things about reducing fertilizer use, increasing fertilizer efficiency, is that it reduces input costs for farmers and can help save them money. And so adopting things like precision agriculture techniques, like variable rate technology that puts just the right amount of fertilizer on every part of the field, that saves farmers money and reduces the amount of nitrous oxide emissions. And nitrous oxide is a potent greenhouse gas. It's 300 times as powerful as carbon dioxide. So that has a great benefit for our climate. Farmers can also do application of nitrogen multiple times instead of adding it all at once in the fall. They can do what's called split applications, and that reduces the amount you need to add because less is lost to the environment, which also helps keep fertilizer out of our streams and rivers.
So, Joe, how will the results of this study influence the work of the Nature Conservancy?
Yeah, great question. The Nature Conservancy is committed to protecting nature, and that includes helping to address climate change. And that starts with transitioning our energy economy to zero carbon energy. But Natural Climate Solutions plays a really important supporting role in helping us avoid the most damaging effects of climate change. And that's something that we're promoting, and we're very excited to see more states stepping up and joining the U.S. Climate Alliance. And we think that's a great place to take action. And they have a Natural and Working Lands Initiative. And the states are really going to be laboratories for figuring out how to implement these win-win solutions.
Will part of the thrust of the Nature Conservancy to take this information, the study results, to policymakers and elected officials?
Yeah, certainly. We think that this is a great set of tools to bring to policymakers because we think there's a lot of win-win opportunities to invest in nature that helps fight climate change and also provides great co-benefits like clean air, clean water, and improved habitat for wildlife. One of the reasons we did the study is that Natural Climate Solutions has really been a forgotten solution to climate change. But because the climate crisis is so urgent, we need to look at all the possible solutions, and that should include nature.
Joe Fargioni is the science director of the Nature Conservancy's North America region. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Benz. You can find a link to the Conservancy study at WUWM.com.
A discussion on the state of a different kind of climate, the arts climate in Milwaukee, comes your way next. We'll speak with Milwaukee Magazine's Lindsay Anderson when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This month's Milwaukee Magazine is devoted to the arts. From artist profiles to a calendar of not-to-be-missed cultural events, the arts issue explores how all of the arts are, or aren't, thriving in our city.
In addition to the profiles and other articles in the issue, the magazine's culture editor, Lindsay Anderson, wrote an overview called The State of the Arts. She joins us now to talk about it. Lindsay, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Great to be here again, Bonnie.
What was the impetus for the article in general? Why now?
Well, at the magazine, we've spent a lot of time lately thinking about areas that the city excels at and areas where it sort of punches above its weight. And we came to the realization that Milwaukee, in a lot of ways, is a great art city, a great performing arts city, a great fine arts city. So we want to just sort of dig into that idea and look into why it punches above its weight and how long it's been doing that for, essentially. So we decided to take a survey of the last roughly 10 years of the city's arts scene and ask a lot of the key players how they feel about the scene here.
So what did you find? Why do people think Milwaukee punches above its weight, or do they think that?
I think most people do tend to believe that. And I think something that came up a lot in the interviews I conducted for the article. Well, a couple things. One, Milwaukee is a cold city in the prairie. There's a lot of wonderful things here, but if we didn't have all of these cultural organizations, the city would just be so much bleaker. There's not necessarily a lot of interesting landscapes or natural resources to draw people here. So I think a lot of the leaders of the city have wisely realized that the arts can be a draw. They can be something that will bring people here and keep people here, want them to stay here. Historically, Milwaukeeans have realized that and invested pretty heavily in the arts here. And then something else that I think came up a lot is that Milwaukeeans are pretty great at sort of working together and working for a greater good when it comes to the health of their arts organizations. The United Performing Arts Fund is the largest performing arts fund of its kind in the country, actually. So it's done a tremendous job of sort of helping these cultural organizations band together and seek out resources. And in general, I think the leaders of a lot of the arts organizations here are just doing a wonderful job of sort of working together to ensure that there's a vital audience here and that all of these organizations are having their needs met.
You mentioned in the article that this kind of cultural support or financial support for the culture exists despite the fact that Wisconsin is, I think, 47th out of 50 in spending, in state spending for the arts. And so we're relying on private donors, essentially, is what this is. Is there any sense or fear that those private donations will dry up?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's always a worry, especially when you think about the fact that a lot of our best-known philanthropists, people like the Baumgartners, are getting up there in years. And I think there's just a concern that there isn't necessarily the same kind of interest in the arts among younger generations. And if there isn't, and that's how we're getting nearly all of our arts funding, that could absolutely be a huge issue.
And even if the younger people do have the interest, they probably don't have the deep pockets.
Right.
That's
the other thing. Yeah. Financially, they're struggling more, too.
And the other thing, I mean, you say Milwaukeeans value the arts, but you point out, and very rightly, that it was voted down to increase the sales tax by what, 0.5%?
Right.
Percent? Not even a percentage point to help support. And nobody wanted to do that.
Right. Yes. And Walker also rolled, when he was still governor, he rolled arts funding into the same sort of funding bucket as tourism. And so, yeah, Wisconsin is really struggling as a state in a lot of ways in terms of art funding. And again, that's another concern. But at least for the time being, I think we found that individuals in Milwaukee seem very willing and interested in investing in the arts. They go to plays, they go to concerts, they get out and they go to these spaces.
Well, they're also funding big building projects, too.
Yes.
You point out, you know, the Milwaukee Ballet is moving into the Third Ward. Just down the street here, the MSO is deep in construction in renovating the Grand Theater. And so those kinds of big projects are being funded.
Absolutely.
But you also point out in the article, and again, I believe rightly so, that a lot of that is not going to individual artists. So we sort of seem to have a disconnect between the institutions, which are doing quite well, at least the bigger ones seem to be doing quite well, and then the individual artists that make up the institutions or might not have anything to do with the institutions because they're visual artists and they're not connected to a performing arts fund. So there seems to be that kind of tension going on as well.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's great that people are willing to donate to large organizations, and organizations like the REP and the Milwaukee Art Museum are doing wonderful work and are very financially healthy right now. But if we don't have a local pool of actors and fine artists and musicians living in Milwaukee and able to make a living as artists in Milwaukee, then those institutions aren't going to be able to continue doing what they're doing too. So I think there are a lot of people out there who are trying to think of ways to continue funding all of the major organizations while also lifting up individual artists. There's a woman named Katie Heil. She's created an initiative called Imagine MKE that's going to publicly launch later this year. But the idea behind that initiative is to provide the sort of funding and support to individual artists that we give to big arts organizations.
So sort of a UPAF for individuals.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of survey results have shown that, well, like I said, Milwaukee does punch above its weight in terms of funding for arts organizations. It doesn't in terms of the way that individual artists fare. They're not as well supported.
You also mentioned in the same, I think in the same paragraph about Katie, Christine Harris, who headed up UPAF a long time ago, but then was part of and headed Creative Alliance Milwaukee, which was an early effort to try to bridge that gap between the individual artists and funding and support and that sort of thing. Did she feel that we were any closer in making that gap either get smaller or go away?
That's a good question. I got the impression that she was tentatively optimistic. I mean, she's very heavily involved with Imagine MKE. And she also pointed to the fact that there are a lot of newer sort of incubator programs in the city that are also sort of stepping in to fill that gap. I believe she mentioned Fellowship.art and Backline. Both of those are incubator programs. Fellowship.art is for visual artists and Backline is for musicians. And the idea behind both is that they sort of step in and provide early career or emerging artists with funding they need to sort of launch their careers.
It's seed money,
yes,
essentially.
Seed yeah, exactly.
Like if you were a business making widgets, you know, instead of seed money for that, it's seed money for your creative.
Right.
The thing I find interesting about all of this is that I love the idea of funding creative projects, individual creative projects. I love the idea of people collaborating with themselves in small ways to make things happen, whether it's sharing gallery space or whatever. But the arts aren't a business. I mean, they are. It's show business, but they aren't.
Right.
And so it seems to me that we need new ways of thinking about the value of the arts. We all say that they're important, but then when it comes to actually, we expect them to pay for themselves like a business would, and they aren't usually.
No, that's absolutely true. I think that's one of the interesting things about being a working artist today, though. We live in a time where there's less of a distinction between your private self and your sort of public persona or brand. And I think there is this push. I don't know if it's even necessarily coming from the artists themselves or from outside pressure, but to sort of turn yourself into a brand.
You are your product.
Right, right. Yeah. And in some sense, I think that's a good thing. It gives artists more of a platform and more control over their career and how they make money. But yeah, like you said, artists, no one gets into art to market themselves as an artist. You get into it to make art. So there's definitely some tension between those two
right,
things.
Right, and making art doesn't always follow a logical
right.
progression.
Yeah.
You know, you're not always like, okay, today I'm going to make, you know, some people do, I'm going to make four paintings today or whatever it happens to be. But a lot of times it's very circuitous.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily, as we used to say in New England, you don't get there from here.
I know that phrase. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think there's something you said for these programs sort of stepping in because it creates a space for artists to focus primarily on the work they're creating instead of focusing on how they're going to get their next side gig, how they're going to market themselves. It allows them to spend more time on actually creating their art.
So once you did this and printed the article, I mean, the entire magazine of this issue is about the arts and what's going on here. How hopeful are you? I mean, looking at it from the outside, from a journalistic perspective, you know, what is your sense of where the art scene is and where it's going?
I think we have a lot of reason to be optimistic. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, Wisconsin in general is not faring well. So I think that's some cause for concern. But in general, I feel like our arts organizations, by and large, are very healthy financially. There's a lot of interest in the arts here. And then I'm also just very encouraged to see organizations like younger organizations like Milwaukee Film or No Studios popping up in the city and generating a lot of buzz and excitement. It just sort of feels like that there's, yeah, just sort of a sense of excitement in the air and that people of all ages are invested in the arts and that maybe they're even a little more invested in them or aware of them or proud of them as sort of a Milwaukee product than they were 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, Lindsay Anderson, I want to thank you so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Bonnie.
Lindsay Anderson is Milwaukee Magazine's culture editor. This month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine is dedicated to the city's art scene.
We will take one last break and then learn about some other arts. Latino Arts' 6th Annual Guitar Festival, which is taking place this weekend. Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about the overall state of the arts in Milwaukee. Well, one of the places the arts is thriving is on the city's Near South Side. Latino Arts is a hub for and a celebration of Latinx artists of all kinds, but its reach goes far beyond them into the larger community.
This Saturday, the 6th Annual Guitar Festival takes place at the Latino Arts Center on South 9th Street. It's a competition for classical guitar students, it's a series of master classes, and it all culminates in a concert by two classical guitar masters, Alfonso Moreno and Oman Kaminsky.
Audio engineer Jason Reavy and I recently met with the director of the Latino Arts String Program, Denora Marquez, Guitar Festival organizer Joan Ruiz Vargas, and two students, Aaron Rodriguez and Diego Gonzalez. Joan began our conversation by explaining how the festival has grown.
The things that we're doing different is we're adding more workshops. Actually, we're doing, it's a classical guitar festival, but we're adding a workshop about jazz improvisation with a really good teacher, Ben Dameron. Also, we are adding a technique class for advanced students, as well art class, maintenance of the guitar, and also a technique class. So That way all kids from 8 to 12, they can participate and they learn a lot. As well, we have 4 people doing masterclass this year.
Who's coming this year?
We have the artist. We have an artist, his name is Alfonso Moreno. He's a friend of Dinora, but he's an amazing Mexican guitarist. And well, the kids that we teach here and playing the mariachi, they've been performing a piece called Fantasía Mexicana that he composed, and they're gonna have the opportunity to play with him.
Cool.
So that's gonna be a big deal for them. As well, we're gonna bring Oman Kaminsky. He is a Mexican guitarist that he have won a lot of competition in Mexico. And we're very happy to bring him because he's gonna teach us a lot of things. As well, in master classes, we're gonna have those 2 artists, plus we're gonna have Ivan Descendis, that he participated in the past 2 years. And also we're gonna have Rene Izquierdo's wife, Elena Shekin, that she's an amazing guitarist. And
she was the first guitarist I ever had on Lake Effect, a classical guitarist, back when we were in our old studio. So this is like 12 years ago, that. And she came and played Bach for me.
Oh.
She's
and it was before I met Rene. And she came and she was wonderful.
Oh, she's an artist in her own right.
Yes.
And also it's just wonderful because she's also a great educator. So to have her be part of the masterclass series will be a real special treat for our students.
How
and
wonderful.
You remember Ivan Resendiz, he actually performed in Lake Effect.
Yes, he did.
He's a great Mexican guitarist as well. He runs the Chicago Guitar Festival as well. So
it's fantastic that you're bringing in, well, using local talent, because we have so much of it, and I think people might be surprised that there's so much classical guitar talent just in the Milwaukee area. We're a big music town, but it's mostly rock and roll people think of, you know?
That's right.
And so it's just really quite wonderful. And you're a graduate of the guitar program,
yes,
right?
The Classical Guitar Studio with Rene. You know, they always bring amazing people to study there, and they participate in the festival, and we have the delight of having those talents to work with us and to participate in everything that we do. So,
you know, if you don't mind, I really kind of want to go back to Rene Izquierdo, and when we first started the guitar program within the Latino Art Strings Room, this was years before the festival, and we were just starting our first students. And they were very basic level. And I spoke with Rene, he had just arrived. And he actually had the students over at UWM. He gave them a master class, he gave them a group class. He just immediately embraced what we were trying to do at this level. So it's really exciting because one of the young students that you're going to hear today, who's actually a senior in high school, will be auditioning to try and study with Rene Izquierdo this coming fall. So our dream has become to, he has fed our program with great teachers by bringing wonderful artists like John Ruiz and several of our other guitar instructors to study with him here at UWM. So we're getting these wonderful instructors into our program, but now they're also helping us train the students that are going to feed into UWM. So it's,
and become the instructors of the future.
And become the instructors and the leaders of this program in the future. So it's really exciting. It's a very organic and supportive environment that Rene and UWM have helped us create for our strings program. So I kind of really want it to be known, you know, because this goes way back to maybe 12 years ago when this all started happening.
Well, and how wonderful that these two sides of town can collaborate in such a great way.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a good connection.
They don't normally talk to each other in a lot of ways, I think.
That's true.
I need to bring you in on this because we mentioned you. Can tell me your name.
My name is Aaron Rodriguez.
And you are going to audition when?
It's mid-March, around that time is when my audition takes place.
Okay. So are you going to play a piece today that you might play for that audition, or is this something completely different?
Actually, the piece I'm playing today is one of my main pieces, or part of my repertoire for my audition in March.
Can you name it, please, and then we'll hear it?
Yeah, so the piece is called Inevitable by Eduardo Martín. Thank you.
was really lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Best of luck with the audition. I think you'll be fine. I think you'll be fine. Well, we have one more student who's sitting here.
Yeah, his name is Diego Gonzalez. Okay. He's my student.
Hi, Diego.
Hi.
And so what are you going to play for us?
I'll be playing Yesterday by the Beatles.
Okay. Before we get to that, though, I want to ask both of you what it's like to participate as students in this guitar festival.
One of the things that we do get out of competing in this festival is that through the competition and through the master classes, we gain like new knowledge on what it is to be a guitarist and a musician. Through the competition, I think we learn how to prepare for the competition, how to make sure we're ready to play in front of the judges. And through the master classes, we learn new techniques and new ways of playing through the guitarists who come and show us what they've experienced.
What's one of the coolest things you learned?
Actually, it's kind of funny. I want to say the first time I competed in the advanced level of the competition, the judge was Mr. René Izquierdo, and he spent the whole 30, 45 minutes of my master class just like teaching me about the proper shape of my nails to be able to play the guitar.
What about you for learning? 4 times you've done it. This will be number 5?
This
will be number 4. Okay.
Well, you know, it's amazing going in. I personally feel really nervous. But afterwards, you know, the relief is just amazing. And a couple years back, I won 3rd place in the intermediate level.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And the feeling that you get when you're on that stage and they call your name out is just, it's amazing. There's no way to explain it. And it's just, I think the most important thing I've learned is that if you're not nervous, you don't care. You're not feeling it, you know what I mean?
I think you're absolutely right. You have to have you have to care about it enough to worry that you're not going to do it right. Before we hear the Beatles, which is a very neat way to end this, what else looking forward? I know I ask you this every single time, but every single time it keeps growing. Where do you think the next big step is for this?
Well, I think for this project, the next big step internally, and it's not really a big step, it's a continuous just growth of the quality of each of our students. And I think we have a staff of guitar instructors that is really dedicated to that. I mean, they're really dedicated to the students as people, just to evolve organically as young men and women. But they're also really devoted to making sure that they will do their very best with whatever their goal is on their instrument. So to continue to grow that is really important. I think that just like René has created a great reputation for UWM, for great guitar, classical guitar instruction and bringing in wonderful students, we'd like to think that we want to create that kind of a reputation for our program, our guitar students as well. So to me, that's a real important part. Externally, I just want people all over the Midwest to know that this is happening. I know there are not a lot of competitions for young people like this. So I'm hoping that as time goes by, we just have too many applicants, you know, that they really want to come and do this and take advantage, because it's a very personal and intimate festival, right? It's everybody who participates is going to get something really, you know, heartfelt to take back. The last winner of the advanced competition last year wrote this wonderful letter about how this had been one of his best musical experiences, just wanting us to continue to grow it and support it. This is a young man who was about 13 years old, so he hasn't had very many experiences, but enough, because he's quite an advanced performer. So, you know, we're just hoping that that continues to go.
Well, and again, the connection between UWM and here is just a natural one.
Totally.
You know, not every student is going to want to do that and you know, audition for René or whatever, but just having that connection to see that there are possibilities out there.
Correct. And then beyond that, I mean, we have 2 exceptional soloists that are coming to this concert, to give this concert, and we just hope that we fill the house. You know, we want people, we've had a couple of full houses for the festival, And, you know, just I think they're going to have an incredible treat. We have an older master who was, you know, the winner of the first Paris competition, who's toured all over the world, who is really coming just out of the goodness of his heart. He's donating the time because he wants to come and inspire and work with the young people. But he's one of the most revered musicians of Mexico at this time, Alfonso Moreno. And then the young up-and-coming Oman Kaminsky. I think they're going to get an incredible treat as a concert. And then you heard the quality of our students. We're going to bring in some really high-level young people. So whoever sits in that stage and shares it with the soloists is going to give us a treat as well.
Dinora Marquez is the director of the Latino Arts String Program. Joan Ruiz Vargas is the coordinator of the Latino Arts Guitar Festival. And Aaron Rodriguez and Diego Gonzalez are local students participating in the festival's competition.
The Latino Arts Guitar Festival takes place this Saturday at Latino Arts. There is more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Like Fact here on Listener Support. 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.